of the Highlands Development Credit Bank Board to order. Thank everyone for coming. As a way of both introduction and roll call, I would ask each member to introduce themselves, starting on my right.
Mike Halpin. I've been here on the phone mostly, but present today.
Susan Kraft. I'm the Director of the Farmland Preservation Program in the State Teen New York Bank Board.
John Weingart. I'm the Highlands Council.
Dale Davis, farmer member.
Ralph Siegel, Garden State Preservation Trust.
And shortly, if he hasn't joined us already, will be Eric Peterson. Eric, are you with us? No, well, we'll hear him beep in when he does come. Okay, at this point, anyone who would care to please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Okay, our first order of business will be approval of our minutes from the March 5th meeting.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, would you read the Open Public Meetings Act for us, please?
Is it in my package?
This
meeting has been covered, has been disclosed under the State Public Meetings Act. So we're okay that way.
Thank you.
Tell us who you notified.
Serious.
We identify, we did our annual report of all the meetings that are going to be held this year in, as I recall, 6 Highlands newspapers.
Okay, so moving on, our first order of business. Acceptance of the minutes that were sent out by Ali over the last weekend. Do I have a motion on that?
I'll move it.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on that? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, so today we've come out, which I appreciate everyone, because it's a nice spring day and I'm sure people would rather be elsewhere. In fact, it does feel kind of warm in the room, so. Jeff LaJava, our administrator, is going to be spending a little time going over the method that we use for the allocation of credits, the HDC credits. We spent almost 2 years on the committee level, at the council level, developing the methodology that Jeff is going to explain to us. We would have liked to keep it on the simple side, simplistic, but we realized we couldn't, that it needed to be hopefully not complicated, but it had to be more than just some of the other examples that were given to us of how HDC could be created, which is, I'll let Jeff go into that also. And then we also are joined today by a consultant, Charlie Seaman, who has worked with us at the council as we were putting together our master plan. Charlie really was instrumental in helping both us and the staff to come up with a very well thought out, thorough plan. He'll be here to explain the TDR portion in the master plan. So I'm thankful that he's here today also. And so at that point, I guess I'll ask Eileen to give her report and move into that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. To start off, what I'd like to do is talk about a land preservation program, RFQ, that we have put out because it has some implications for the TDR program as well as for the council. So we'll be asking the council to consider this at our next meeting. What we did is we put out a request for qualifications by the Highlands Council for a consultant who would provide support for the Highlands Council land preservation program. We received 3 responses, and staff is presently reviewing the qualifications. And as I said, we expect to take action on this at the next council meeting. The scope of services that we've asked them to consider, and this will be very relevant to the TDR program as well, is the development of a regional clearinghouse of information regarding preservation programs, innovative tools, and funding sources for land acquisition consistent with our regional master plan. We've also asked this, that this consultant would help us identify willing sellers and facilitate funding contributions with appropriate federal, state, county, municipal, and non-profit land preservation agencies under new or existing programs. Also, we've asked them to assist us in prioritizing land acquisition activities. We were required under the Highlands Act to do conservation priority lists for both Green Acres and the SADC and did that, but we'd be asking that this consultant would continue to assist us with this work in terms of augmenting those priority lists where necessary and reviewing them from time to time as well to look at, this, at the programs and how many of these properties do actually get acquired for preservation. We were also asking for a landowner assistance, education and outreach program to provide technical and assistance guidance to landowners in the region. And finally, to assist the Highlands Council with implementation of the Highlands Transfer Development Right program. So I wanted to bring that to your attention, and after the next council meeting, I'll report out again at your next meeting to you on that. Also, just the way business is handled within the your staff, the Highlands Council staff, to let you know about our constituent services, because I think it's important. You do, as you know, have public comment periods at these meetings, as we do at the Highlands Council meetings, but there are members of the public who want to have answers to questions, and this is a place where they can make comment. But if they wish to get answers, we have a constituent team on the staff, so on every day there's a staff member assigned to take these calls and respond to concerns. If we can't respond at the time, we get back to these landowners or interested parties, whoever it is, within the region or outside the region that have questions pertaining to the council's work and indeed your work. So just so that you understand that we do these, we take these calls, we do respond, and we give whatever information or advice and assistance that we can. I want to give you a status on our TDR receiving zone feasibility grants, just to let you know where we are with that program and who is participating. The Highlands Council allocated $1 million in grant funding to provide incentive funding to municipalities to consider being receiving areas. This applies to anywhere within the seven counties of the Highlands region. It's not just the Highlands region itself. And this grant is so that those that are currently interested or perhaps thinking about increasing density for new development or redevelopment get to consider using this program to do that. And so we provide the monies to assist them. Currently, Chester Borough is working with us. They received their grant November 20th of 2008. So their consultants have started the work on with a particular focus on looking at the infrastructure capacity in the borough and appropriate future expansion of that infrastructure to support the possibility of a receiving zone. Incidentally, just for your information, if a town does this feasibility study and decides that they're not going to use TDR, we understand that. The fact is that this planning is important, and it's important information for them anyway to understand their capacity constraints or possibilities for future expansion. The City of Clifton also expressed interest, and they received a feasibility grant October 4, 2007. They have conducted their initial assessment of potential parcels for consideration, and currently those parcels are being discussed and assessed by the City's Economic Development Committee. The Town of Clinton received a grant April 10, 2008, and their consulting planners have held meetings with the Town's Smart Growth Committee, and they've prepared concepts for potential receiving sites, ruled out others, and are now focusing on feasible economics of the potential transfer for the sites in which they're interested. Lopatcong Township received a grant September 20th of 2007. They've completed their study, and their conclusion has been that it is not feasible at this time to serve as a receiving zone. Washington Borough received a grant October 30th, 2008, and they've begun work on the program. There are other municipalities, as we go out and do our informational sessions, that have expressed interest and are beginning to look at the possibilities, and we hope will come in to apply for that grant. And we've recently had calls from one non-Highlands community within the seven counties. We've also asked to set up a meeting with us to begin that discussion, because they're possibly interested in applying for this grant and doing the study. So that brings me to the end of the report. I would like to, and it was requested by the chair, that I talk a little bit about our experience working with Charlie Seaman, who Scott referred to earlier, who's with us today. And just to give you a very short background, Charlie is to say 30 years of experience in 30 states, including the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. So I think that in itself says a lot about his contribution to planning as a land use attorney and as a planning across the United States of America. We're also, just a little bit about our experience working with Charlie. He brought so much experience from even the state of New Jersey. Charlie worked on the state plan, the original state plan. He worked on the Pinelands plan. He worked on transportation planning in Bergen County. So he's had considerable experience in the state, and I think we were very fortunate when we brought him on board in the Highlands Council, because he worked with us on the redraft of the second release, the second draft plan of the Highlands Council, and played a great role as well in drafting the TDR component, because we felt it was critical that we had somebody with that kind of perspective to assist us in this very, very complex plan. Complex because of the nature of the Highlands, not because of any desire to be complicated, as Scott said earlier. We found that working with Charlie was, he instigated great conversations, great studies, energized the staff and the council, and assisted us in coming up with a plan that we felt had great credibility, phenomenal amount of study behind it, and great defensibility moving forward. So we're pleased to have Charlie here today to assist in the presentation of the TDR program.
Okay, thank you. So I assume we'll move right into this portion of it. Jeff LaJava, our administrator, will be leading this side. We'd be going right into a PowerPoint.
Everyone, if you'd like to move to be able to see the screen, that's fine. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the board. Today's primary focus is to discuss the details of the Highlands TDR program. Before we get into that, I'm going to ask Charlie just to give some introductory remarks based on his work with the staff and the council on the TDR program, and also to provide you a flavor based on his national and international experience in dealing with transfer of development rights. So with that, Charlie, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the bank. It's a pleasure to be here. It's been a pleasure to work with all of you and many of the people in the audience who've been, at least during my tenure over the last 2 years, working on this. I have been privileged to work in a number of programs that have been at the lead of TDRs, and I would like to first just share a few perspectives generally about TDRs, talk a little bit about the specific program from a sort of strategic perspective, and then Jeff will take you through the details of the programs. TDRs have been around for about 40 years. As the environmental movement began to affect resource planning and management in this country, the effect of new programs on property owner expectations was a matter of pretty significant concern. And at the time, it was largely framed in the context of the taking issue. How far can you go under the constitutions of the individual states and the United States Constitution? And I think while much of the debate focused on how far can you go, there was also a component of it is just because you can go that far, is it really fair to have a program that results in what Don Hagman called windfalls and wipeouts? Some people had their property designated for great growth and it created great wealth, and others had the alternative experience. And a number of really creative thinkers tried to work through how we could not satisfy, or while there was a lot of discussion about whether TDRs, what effect they would have on a claim of a taking, the principal understanding was an effort to bring a more equitable balance between those who receive windfalls and those who receive wipeouts. And the basic concept was those who got windfalls ought not to get it all just because they were lucky, that some of that ought to be shared with those who are, quote-unquote, serving experience of a wipeout. And TDRs were created or identified as an opportunity. John Costonis wrote a book called Space Adrift, which is about using that approach in New York to preserve historic buildings. And I was very fortunate. My first job after I graduated from law school was at the firm of Ross Hardy, Zocchi, Babcock & Parsons, and I took John Costonis' position when he went off to be a professor. And so I went to work at a place where Space Adrift was actually a research project and drafted. And we've been blessed in the years subsequent to that to work in a number of programs. I want to make sure that everybody understands my perspective. We've helped communities establish TDR programs around the country. And TDRs are, I believe, the only practical tool we have to really address the windfall wipeout phenomenon. But it's not a panacea. It's a tool, and it's just like a wrench. It has to be used on the appropriate, has to be the appropriate size, and it has to be used wisely to be effective. And I made a note here. One of the things I wanted to tell you was that making TDRs work is hard work. It doesn't happen easily. It needs to be worked hard, and I perceive that your responsibilities here are significant in terms of making it work. And it involves some perspectives that I think are important. My view of a TDR program, the public responsibility in including a TDR program in a resource planning and management program, is to create the opportunity for balancing the windfalls and wipeouts of a new program. And what's really important is that it's a real opportunity that people can use. And you have to be careful in measuring the success, particularly at the early part of a TDR program, because often, very often, property owners and others don't take advantage of that opportunity, sometimes for many, many years. But in doing equity, I believe that creating that meaningful opportunity to be used when the market will support it, when the property owners will participate, when developers need additional opportunities, is the critical public policy, the responsibility of a program like the Highlands Plan, like the Pinelands Plan, like many others around the country. And it's important that that opportunity is the benchmark of success, not how many transfers do you have in the first 2 or 5 or even 10 years. It takes many, many years for the market to respond. In almost every market, there is existing product that might have 5, even 10 years before it's fully absorbed from past development activities. So you need to understand that that is a phenomenon you're going to deal with. There's also an issue that needs to be kept in mind. I don't know that it really guides, but in my view, it needs to be kept in mind, and that is that value and expectations and market value are not fixed matters. They're relative, and that the time value. Everybody in a group, a population of property owners, all believes their property is worth what the last farm sold for. But the fact of the matter is, if everybody tried to realize value all at the same time, the supply of land would drive the price down. And so in doing equity, there needs to be a perspective of who are the most stressed properties, who have suffered the biggest immediate impact of a new program, and allocate your energies on a priority basis. And that is important. I think you often also need to keep in mind that there is another part of the equation. There are concerns about the program is unfair. It doesn't do enough for us. The equation, the land use equation, is not just all about the intrinsic value of land. The intrinsic value of N is basically what you can farm it for or mine it. The other uses of land and the value that comes from it is a result of collective matters as well as the intrinsic value of the land. That is, the infrastructure that makes land developable. And so you need, in working through this balancing of the equities, there needs to be a recognition on both sides of the equation that there's no way in the world that everything can be mitigated. And if you take proper consideration of the time value of land, the geographic location of the land, and prioritize your promotional activities to those properties which have received the most extreme impacts, that is very important to the long-term success of the program. TDRs are defined by the market. The creation of a bank to facilitate that market, to make to buy units when there is no market opportunity for them. But there's limitations on that because you can only buy so many. If you can't, the bank can't resell those to someone else because the market won't support it. So there needs to be some practical, some realistic expectations about TDRs. There'll be, I would predict, some opportunity for some people to do like they do with real estate, which is to try to establish a position on which they can make a profit. But the reality is, if there's no market, the TDRs have limited applicability. Of course, if there's no market, the impact of the new regulations on expectations is also affected by the fact of that lack of market. While we, in this program, have a certain valuation period, in doing equity, again, which is what the objective of this program is, I believe you need to take that. I'm just going to make a few comments before Jeff goes about this program. In anticipation coming back, I reread everything in the plan, all the materials that have been produced, all the analyses that were done. And frankly, while I had some concerns about the complexity of some parts of the program at the time, I think the program, given the limitations of the statute, holds up very well. And I can't be, and I usually am pretty critical about my work a year or two or 3 years later, I think that we collectively did the work that was necessary to create a credible program. And given the limitations of the statute, I don't know what major changes I would make other than funding the bank in a significant way and ultimately linking it to a long-term regional redevelopment strategy and a long-term water resources funding mechanism. But in terms of the nuts and bolts of this program, I think the program really stands up very well. I know that I had grave reservations, I must say, at one point about the complexity of analysis. Because I think it's so difficult to follow. I think it's most of us, our eyes glaze over as we're going through the details. But in retrospect, so long as the outcome is transparent and easy to use, and part of that easy to use is the direction and the support that this bank gives the system and staff gives the system, I think that complexity will serve the program well because the analysis, I believe, shows to everybody that this is not pulled out of the sky. This is not a swag. It was based on real data and a set of assumptions that I think can be supported both in the marketplace of ideas, and I think if somebody were to challenge it in court, it would stand up very well. I do want to say that I have a rule about TDRs, keep it simple, a KISS, keep it simple, S, another S. That's a rule which is guided to make the program work. And I think as long as the implementation of this program is focused on easy access, transparent access to why my allocation is X, Y, or Z, the fact that it's grounded in a very complex analytical model, I think is can be overcome, and I think the overall integrity of it is important. Finally, I think that the most successful TDR programs are one where there's a long-term perspective, there's a lot of patience, that it's worked really hard. Creativity, adaptability, and understanding the market and working with the market, not fighting the market, are, I think, really vital. And I believe that you all have, despite all the limitations, I'd love to redo the statute and get rid of some of those things that are problematic. But I believe the tool can be used and can be used successfully if you as you go forward.
Before Jeff starts, I just wanted to point out, because Charlie there focused on transparency and access, to let everybody know we prepared a memo which we put on the calendar page for today so that the public can go back and sort of review what we're going to talk about today. And we showed them where to go in our technical documents, because our master plan and all the technical documents that support it are online. But we designed this memo such that instead of reading from the beginning and the end of the technical document, you can use the memo to go back to those technical documents to focus on where these issues are addressed. And that's in the spirit, again, of transparency and access.
Great. Charlie, thank you very much for the introductory remarks. And I mean, for pointing out the memo that we posted yesterday. I think it's important, before we get into the nuts and bolts of the program, to also understand what were the matters, what were the factual circumstances that shaped the program the way it is, the way the council adopted it in the regional master plan. You know, first and foremost, we have the TDR section of the Highlands Act. That had some very specific requirements, one of which was that any receiving zones are going to be voluntary. We are also guided by the State TDR Act, the legal principles underlying transfer of development rights and takings law. We then looked at existing TDR programs, both here in the state. You know, as we discussed at the last meeting, Susan presented on Chesterfield Township. Larry Liggett spoke about the Pinelands program. We looked outside of New Jersey. We looked at the Long Island Pine Barrens program. We looked at programs in Colorado, in the state of Washington, Maryland, all across the country, to try to identify what were those aspects or elements of a program that helped to make it successful. One of the biggest things that we learned from that research was the importance of a bank, and hence why the council felt it was necessary to establish this body ultimately for the success of the program. We also got input from stakeholder groups, which we had set up, a technical advisory committee. We had an ad hoc committee that also met with the TDR committee, and all of these meetings were held publicly. So all of those things kind of gave us the initial framework. And then we were also guided by three important circumstances that makes this program different than most of the other programs in the country. The first is the scale of the program. The number of municipalities that have the ability to participate is larger than anything else anywhere in the United States. As far as amount of acreage is concerned, the Pinelands program is probably one of the largest on an area-wide basis. But as far as the number of municipalities, local governments that can participate, it is large. The other significant factor was the variability in real estate market values across the region. If you looked at a property in Bergen County zoned at 1 unit to the acre and compared that to a property zoned at 1 unit to the acre in Warren County, those values are significantly different. And we needed to consider that and accommodate that variability. And I will talk about that in a little bit. And the last thing is, as I mentioned when discussing this TDR section of the Highlands Act, is that our receiving zones are voluntary. That in and of itself does create hurdles, but hurdles that can be overcome with time. So the TDR program is meant to be a regional program. That will take time to develop. Most likely what we will see is municipalities possibly participating on an intra-municipal basis where they're seeking to take credits generated from the preservation area of their community and to transfer those to the planning area portion of their community where they are split. We will also have, hopefully, receiving zones established outside of the Highlands region where those communities have the infrastructure necessary to support increased growth, and we can generate revenue for the preservation of properties within. You know, you've heard a lot at the last meeting, and Charlie discussed the general aspect or concept of TDR. You've got sending zones where you want to protect, receiving zones where that lost development potential is going to be transferred to. The landowners in the sending zones in our program will receive an allocation of Highlands Development Credits, or HDCs, because of the limitations placed on their property by the Act, which they may then sell at a later time, possibly to the bank or to developers or others once receiving zones are established. When those HDCs are purchased, then it allows you to redeem them for use in a receiving zone, building at a density or intensity greater than what would otherwise be permitted. And again, these are just important concepts to keep in mind. And again, I highlight the receiving zones are voluntary. Five main components of our program are very similar to most of the programs around the country. Sending zones, receiving zones, and allocation. We'll talk about this in more detail shortly, but allocation is an essential element of any program. How are property owners who have been affected by a given regulation or have volunteered to be affected by that regulation, how do they get their credits? How many credits do they get allocated? It's a very important element of any program. The Highlands Act required the Highlands Council to establish an initial value, and we'll talk about that. And what we will not talk about today with any specific detail is the bank itself. Sending zones. The sending zones are designated or identified by the regional master plan based on the goals, policies, and objectives that you find in Chapter 4 of the RMP. So all lands located within the preservation area are eligible, except for those that are located in the existing community zone or approved Highlands redevelopment areas. Those will be areas that the Highlands Council designates through a designation process moving forward for lands that are either constitute have 70% impervious surface or identified as Highlands brownfields. And then upon conformance, lands located within the planning area, again, except for those located in the existing community zone or approved redevelopment areas, would also be eligible. But that eligibility does not kick in until a municipality in the planning area has voluntarily conformed. And then the limitations and standards of the regional master plan that may have an effect on a property could create eligibility. In addition to those area thresholds, we also establish some minimum thresholds to deal with the fact that we're trying to address providing equity for property owners who have been truly affected by the Act. The Act does provide through DEP right now in the preservation area several waivers. A waiver for regulatory takings, a waiver for public health and safety, and the redevelopment waiver as well. And in addition, the Act provides 17 exemptions. So what we were trying to do is understanding that those equity concepts are built into the waiver process and into the exemptions. What we're really trying to get at is providing equity to those property owners that have been truly affected. So in addition to the land area, what zone you're in, it's important, and the council established this again in the regional master plan, that the parcel has to be at least 5 acres in size or have lost at least 3 development opportunities. There are situations where a property could be zoned, smaller than 5 acres, but let's say it's zoned at 1 unit per half acre. And so they have a 3-acre parcel, they get, one exemption, and they would have lost 5 units due to the Act. They should also be able to participate. So it's the 5 acres in size or 3 development opportunities. That's an important distinction. And the other point that I want to raise is that even where these thresholds may be met, it's still possible for a parcel to not receive an allocation because of limitations that may have been, development limitations or environmental constraints that may have been placed on the property prior to the Highlands Act ever coming into existence, either due to, let's say, DEP's freshwater wetlands regulations or the effect of either municipal zoning. So you could have a, let's say, 11-acre parcel in a township that has 7-acre zoning. Well, under the Highlands Act, you would still get your exemption, and you were never going to get any more development than what would have been allowed under your municipal zoning ordinance at the time, which would have been one unit, even though you had 11 acres. So that's important to understand. These are just several examples of receiving zones and areas. Here in New Jersey, one is in Washington Township in Mercer County. I believe it did change its name to Robbinsville. And then the Livingston Town Center in Essex County, which is not TDR, but certainly looked at dealing with mixed-use development, the type of development that may be appropriate in a receiving zone using Highlands Development Credits. So like the sending zones, the receiving zones also have area requirements. Under the Regional Master Plan, receiving zones can be located in anywhere in the existing community zone or in a Highlands Redevelopment Area. They can also be located within the conservation zone, and that's primarily our ag lands here in the Highlands region, provided that that designation is consistent with the Regional Master Plan. Let's say it may have to meet certain clustering requirements or like, and it doesn't conflict with the maintenance of viable agriculture. The conservation zone lands probably have to go a couple extra steps to become receiving zones, but it is possible. And we wanted to ensure that we created as much flexibility and opportunity to create receiving zones within the Highlands region, hence why we have these policies that we do. And then, of course, we've talked about this previously, lands located outside of the Highlands region but within the seven Highlands counties may also serve as receiving zones. As Eileen mentioned in her executive director's report, we have five municipalities that are undertaking TDR receiving zone feasibility grant activities. Lopatcong Township has completed theirs. We do have several other municipalities that have expressed interest in submitting grant applications, including municipalities located outside of the Highlands region. Now we get into the meat of the program, allocation. How many credits do I get for my property because the Highlands Act has impacted me? That's the primary question that you're trying to answer with allocation. We looked at a number of methods that other programs have used. We looked at, can we just simply give a credit for so many gross acres of a given land type? So if you have 40 acres of wetlands, you would get one credit, but if you have 5 acres of uplands, you know, dry area, you get one credit. We looked at doing it strictly on a value basis. And the recognition that we have significant variability, not only in the real estate markets within the Highlands region, but also within landforms and land types, we needed to come up with a hybrid approach. So our approach looks at what you could have developed prior to the Highlands Act, the market, real estate market, where that property is relative to the rest of the region, and what was the zoning applicable to that property and how could that affect value. So there are three questions that the allocation method answers with respect to residential property. Where is it located, the acres of the property, and what's the applicable zoning? Those three questions are answered by these three components. Net yield. How many lots could I have located on my parcel given pre-Highlands Act environmental constraints and our municipal development regulations? That's your base number. If I could have gotten 5 lots prior to the Highlands Act, now I have one exemption I lost four lots. I'm starting with a base of four credits. That's your debt yield factor. We have a location factor. It's an adjustment that accounts for relative differences in land value for similarly zoned properties across the Highlands municipalities. The example I gave earlier, a parcel in Bergen County zoned at 1 unit to the acre compared to that parcel in Warren County zoned at that same density. And then a zoning factor that accounts for relative differences in land value due to the applicable zoning. I have this property that's zoned for 1 unit per 5 acres has a very different underlying land value from a zoning district that's has a density of 1 unit per half an acre. So where's the property located? What does that impact on our allocation method? Well, foremost, it deals with your location factor. Again, this factor is meant to deal with relative differences in land value for similarly zoned type properties across the region. We needed to make this adjustment for a very simple purpose. If we had just allocated credits to everyone on the same basis and said, you've lost 1 unit, whether it's an apartment, townhouse, or whatever, and regardless of where you're located, you got 1 unit. It would have created a situation over time where the lowest value credits would be the first that would be purchased by developers to be used in the highest value receiving zones. Over time, the whole program would have ground to a halt because what would have been left are high value credits in the ability to use them in lower value receiving zones, and they would have just sat. So we needed to kind of normalize for that differences, and that was one of the primary purposes of this location factor. How many acres is the parcel? Well, that obviously affects net yield. The acreage combined with what the underlying zoning is going to affect your yield, and that's an important consideration. And then finally, what is the zoning? It's going to affect your net yield. It does affect your location factor because we're trying to understand relative differences in similarly zoned properties across the region. And then a zoning factor. The difference between I have a property that's zoned at 1 unit per 5 acres compared to a property elsewhere in town that's zoned at 1 unit per half an acre. And we needed to make these two adjustments. So how does this work? We put together, this was an example that we had put together for the TDR committee back in May of last year when it was considering the allocation method and then also presented this to the council. Working from left to right, you look at municipality, that affects your location factor. You look at the zoning. In this first example in Chester Township, it's a 3-acre lot. The parcel size is 20 acres. So accounting for that size and accounting for the zoning, you had a potential yield of 6 lots. We have a number of lookup tables relating to our zoning factors and location factors, which are available on the TDR technical report, which have been posted on the website and been available for some time. So the way you would, for example, find out what's the location factor, you'd find that municipality. You look to the tables relating to zoning. In this case, it's for lots between 2 to 5 acres or greater than 2 acres to 5 acres. You would find Chester Township, find the applicable location factor, and that gets plugged in. And on the zoning factor, here the zoning is 3-acre lots again. There's one table for your zoning factor because we looked at it on an average basis across the entire region. You go to the appropriate composite zoning classification for that, and you would put in this number. In this case, it's 1.37. And then it's a multiplication process. 6 times 1.37 times 3.23 gives you the HDC allocation, how many credits that property is entitled to under this formula. And then just to provide a better sense of what that means, the council has established an initial HDC price of $16,000 per credit. So using that figure, multiply 26.55 times 16,000, it gives you the value of that allocation. And then we did that, on a, divided that by the number of lots to give a per lot value, and divided that total value by the number of acres to give you a per acre value. And so for examples A through D, that's the process we would follow. It was also important to recognize that even though a property might be environmentally constrained, the council had said we have conservation priority areas and ag priority areas. And there are different levels of that, a high value area, moderate and low. And we needed to account and create a bonus, if you will, for property owners who might otherwise exercise an exemption. So let's say they had, in this case, a 20-acre parcel in Chester. The preference would be not to see that parcel developed with that one exemption, just because of fragmentation of ecosystems and the like. And so the council created a bonus where the net yield is multiplied by given a 25% bonus. So in this case, it goes up to 6.25 as your base number, and then multiplied by the same zoning and location factors. It, in this case, increases slightly the number of credits you get allocated.
So you're giving a differential treatment between development potential prior to the Highlands Act and development potential that exists with the Highlands Act?
No, it's actually an incentive to not exercise an exemption.
Right.
So
the person could.
Yep.
It's a development right they retain.
Correct. If they retain it.
Highlands Act.
Exactly.
So that development right is being given a bonus consideration, a higher value.
Yes.
Than the development right that existed prior to the Act.
Yes. If I'm understanding the question correctly, yes.
Doesn't the example for if those 5 acres of wetlands, in example E, were regulated under the Fresh Water Wetlands Act, and this, they couldn't use their exemption there either?
Well, they could because they have other. I mean, it's a 20-acre parcel.
15 acres.
So they could. There's 15 other acres that are non-constrained where they could locate that exemption. So, you know, that loss of 5 acres would have reduced their number of potential lots. But then when you get this basically a kicker, one, multiplying your net yield by 1.25, a 25% bonus, you wind up with the 6.25. And again, it's a means of trying to incentivize property owners where it works for them economically to not exercise an exemption.
Jeff, how is 6.25 a 25% bonus?
Because it's they would only get 5 lots because it's a 20-acre parcel with 3-acre zoning, and let's assume, you know, those other 15 acres are not constrained.
Oh.
So it's 5 lots multiplied by 1.25, arriving at 6.25.
Okay.
For your net yield.
Okay.
That is the basis of the allocation system, and as Charlie mentioned, the complexity that was discussed both by the committee and by the council had a lot to do with the analysis that we did, the information that we used, the data that we synthesized to come up with our location and zoning factors. But in its application itself, it should be fairly straightforward. We will be moving forward shortly with a web-based tool where a property owner can put in their block and lot information. And we will have done, on a regional basis, a net yield analysis, and then the program will also apply the location and zoning factor so that property owners have a sense of how many credits they might be allocated when they come in for a formal allocation determination by the Highlands Council. That, that tool will also break out the components of that allocation, so you will know what your net yield was. You will know what the location factor was that was applied. You will know what the zoning factor was that got applied. And you can multiply that out and do the same math to check. But again, this is a tool to provide information to property owners so they have a sense of the number of credits they may be allocated through the more formal process.
Are
Are the credits that are allocated, like in Chester Township, are they all going to be the same? If it's the same, it would be the same. If it's another spot, 20 acres, it's all the same.
But it could be different if the zoning was different.
Okay, but if the zoning
is the same. But if the zoning is the same, you're going to find.
You're not taking it in any context of, okay, this has got, 5,000 foot of frontage.
No.
This one's got one.
No,
the equation is always the same. It's the plug-in information.
And that could change, but to your point, Mr. Davis, no. The fact is, if we had gone that route to deal with road frontage, does it have existing approvals, everything else, talk about creating a really complex allocation process. So we made the decision at the staff level when that was presented to the committee and then ultimately the council for its approval that we wanted to try to account for the major differences in underlying land values that you see regionally, where the property is located, and the zoning associated with that property as of August 9th, 2004, the day before the Highlands was enacted.
But the environmental constraints is being taken into account. If you had two 20-acre tracts with the same zoning in the same town, one's mostly wetlands and one's not, that's feeding into your net yield calculation.
Correct. So,
that is...
That definitely could have an impact.
Okay.
But if you took same properties, same amount of environmental constraints, let's assume no constraints, same zoning within that township, it's going to have a similar allocation.
And Jeff, just to be clear on that, the point where the information about what is constrained, that will be given to a landowner when they ask for certification?
Yeah, what...
That's not something they can just go on the web and find out, correct?
It will, the web-based tool, the purpose of it will also be to identify the constrained area. So you'll see that visually. It's an aggregate of all the various pre-Highlands Act environmental constraints. And you will see that when you look on the tool itself.
One of the different layers of the map.
It will combine all of those to say this is the environmentally constrained portion. So we then applied looked at the non-constrained portion, applied the zoning to create your net yields. Now when a property owner comes in for a formal allocation, they'll be able to submit additional information to say, I think your tool got it wrong. The wetlands buffer that you said is there, well, you know what, in fact, there are actually no wetlands. So factual matters related to environmental constraints and the zoning, let's say somehow we either got the zoning wrong or the zoning changed, 6 months after what we were looking at, and we applied what was there 6 months after because of the information and data we received from the municipality, a property owner will have the ability to bring that information to the council for purposes of the allocation determination. If after they get the formal allocation, they still don't agree with it, they will have an opportunity for formal reconsideration. That will be an application process in the hearing. And I'll be laying that out in the future for the board so they have a better understanding of how that process works. Are there any other questions on the residential allocation process before I move to our non-residential, which is actually less complicated?
Just one question, something you just touched on was, let's say you have a property in the planning area, and the township changed the zoning after the date of enactment of the Highlands. Are you looking at the zoning that was in place back when it was enacted, or are you looking at the most current zoning of that property?
For purposes of the environmental constraints, we're supposed to look back to DEP's rules and regulations prior, but I believe with the zoning, it would be at the time once the municipality had voluntarily conformed, it would be looking at that pre-conformance zoning compared to zoning now under conformance with the regional master plan for purposes of that. Our program is also different than a lot of programs around the country because we're also going to be allocating credits to non-residentially zoned property. The Pinelands, for example, dealt with allocation, and their program is purely on a residential basis. And Mr. Liggett, when he was here at our last meeting, did explain that one of the enhancements that they're looking to put into the program is to address non-residential development in pulling that into the receiving zones and the use of credits and everything else. We felt it was necessary to do that right up front. So similar to the residential allocation process, we see the same kind of three questions. How many acres is the property? What the applicable zoning is? And the non-residential development, what type can be constructed? We had looked at trying to come up with a location adjustment for non-residential, a non-residentially zoned property, similar to what we did on our location factor for our residential allocation. And we looked at dividing the Highlands region into primary, secondary, and tertiary commercial markets based on a number of existing real estate market data. We ran into issues about defining the boundaries of those markets and everything else. And we said, you know what, we're actually dealing with approximately 3,500 acres in the preservation area that's undeveloped and non-residentially zoned. And due to the difficulties that we were having, we said we should just be treating these properties the same. Whether you're in a primary, secondary, or tertiary market, we're going to allocate on the same basis relating to dollar per square foot values that you see for different types of development within the Highlands region. And we worked very closely with our consultant, Integra Realty Resources, based on their knowledge of the market throughout the Highlands region on what those values should be. And we created ratios, looking at industrial, office, and retail types of development. We compared the dollar per square foot values. We took the midpoint. You'll see the second column from the left where it says dollar per square foot FAR range. We took the midpoint of those ranges and used those for purposes of establishing a ratio. And then we did a conversion factor looking at the number of employees, which is used in evaluation purposes for non-residential development, and using the industrial uses tend to support one employee in a ratio of 1,500 square feet. We created these ratios with a number of the amount of square footage that would get allocated a credit for a different type of non-residential use. So on the first line there, excuse me, where it says industrial use, and I apologize that I didn't bring a pointer with me, that makes it a little bit difficult, but under where it says industrial use, you'll see the square footage is divided by one. That's the ratio that you see in the upper right-hand corner to give you 1,500 feet. So to determine what an allocation would be for an industrially zoned non-residential property, it would be the amount of square footage that would be permitted under the zoning ordinance, taking into account parking regulations and the like, divided by the amount of square footage for the industrial building conversion factor gives you a yield. So in the example below, a 10,000 square foot industrial building divided by 1,500 square feet, rounded up, becomes 7 Highlands Development Credits. And then applying those same ratios for office building and retail building, you follow out, divide, and get your credit allocation. So it is a simpler allocation method. What is more difficult is determining what the underlying zoning ordinance would have permitted just prior to enactment of the Highlands Act, because you need to account for impervious coverage limitations that might be there, a floor area ratio that might be built in. Many municipalities have an FAR standard for non-residential development, and accounting for your parking regulations. The other main component to discuss today is the initial HDC price that the Highlands Council established in the assessment that we went through as staff and then with the TDR committee to arrive at this $16,000 per credit amount. Under the Highlands Act, in the TDR provision, it specifically required that the Highlands Council establish an initial value of a development right, taking into consideration the DEP regulations that were in place the day prior to enactment of the Highlands Act, which was August 10th, 2004. In trying to arrive at what that value should be, and one of the difficulties that we have in doing that is a portion of the overall TDR equation is missing. Our receiving zones are entirely voluntary. In most programs where you have a known sending and receiving districts, you're able to value your underlying land values in your sending area, comparing that to underlying land values and unit values in your receiving districts, and then you're able to establish what the proper ratio should be and then a value to those credits. We were missing part of that equation. So in setting out to try to meet this requirement of the Act, we said there are two important interests that we need to balance. The first is that the price must be sufficient for sending zone landowners to realize an economic return on the sale of their HDCs. It might not be the value that they believe that they should be getting, but that it has to be a sufficient value. On the flip side of that, the value of the HDCs can't be so great that when a developer wants to use them in a receiving zone, it undermines the receiving zone project because the economics don't work. You know, it either keeps them from realizing their profit, which is the whole motive that drives TDR, or it makes it, you know, it creates a break-even point where they're better off just building at the underlying zoning in the receiving zone as opposed to building at a TDR density. So those were the two competing interests that we kept in mind as we were moving forward. And then also understanding, based on experiences of programs around the country, that over time the value of the Highlands Development Credits will increase as more opportunities to use those credits arise. That's what we saw in the Pinelands. That's what we saw in Long Island Pine Barrens. That's what we've seen in the various programs in Colorado and Washington and California. The fundamental principle underlying any TDR program is that for each additional unit on a given lot that you could put in a receiving zone, that increase in revenue is going to be greater than the increase in development costs, i.e. there has to be a profit motive for a developer to use that credit. For a developer, their main source of savings is that as they're getting more bonus units or more non-residential square footage on a given parcel of land, they're reducing their land costs. So in the case of residential property, if they're able to build at a greater density than they would otherwise be allowed to build at, then they're going to lower their land costs. The same with non-residential. If they can get more floor area per a given parcel size, they're going to reduce their overall unit land costs. And all of this must address this issue of developers' willingness to pay. What can a developer pay to still realize their profit while building at the TDR density or intensity of use, accounting for the cost of that credit? So what was the methodology that we used? We sought to predict what the added value of a given lot would be where you were going from 4 units to the acre to 5 units to the acre. And you might ask, well, why did you choose that threshold? We did it because under the receiving zone section of the Highlands Act, the benefits and incentives that flow to a municipality for establishing a receiving zone kick in when they have a minimum residential density of 5 dwelling units to the acre or its non-residential equivalent. So we wanted to see, if you're adding that fifth lot, what's that added value to a developer? And what would they be willing to pay for it? So we used a data set that was comprised of tax assessment information because it was the most comprehensive data set that we had for the time period we were looking at, which was really the 2004-2000 time frame. we had that information for lots all across, and we used equalized assessed data. The purpose of equalizing that is to try to adjust it as close to possible as to fair market value for tax assessment purposes. We also use that because tax assessment data is used every day. Banks use it for purposes of understanding valuations. It's you know, the way we designate how much money we pay in property taxes. So it's understood. Using that data set, we looked at parcels that were developed with residential homes and that couldn't be further subdivided, meaning they had no additional development potential. We then rolled up for a given municipality its average per acre lot values, and we applied four mathematical functions. And I don't think it's worth going into all the intricacies of doing that, but to try to we use these mathematical functions to try to predict what the value of that fifth lot would be. We came up with lot values for all the municipalities across the Highlands region. We then reduced that by 30%. We did that because the lots we were looking at were already approved and they were already improved. And what we're trying to get at is the land cost for undeveloped land. So we took a 30% reduction. And we created, and you'll see in the charts that you all have, and again, that's on incorporated within the technical report, there's a column that says lot values, and it shows the lot values with a 30% reduction on average for every municipality. We then applied a further adjustment to that, which was a 75%, but let me take one step back, and I apologize. After we had reduced lot values for every municipality by 30%, we then got an average for the entire region, which I believe, let's see, is, I'm going to flip back here for a second, $64,657.25. We then applied a further adjustment, the 75% reduction, to deal with this issue of developers' willingness to pay. Now, in programs like the Pinelands program, like the Pine Barrens program, and others, when they were trying to figure out how to price their credits initially, they applied the same concept of a developer's willingness to pay, but they applied a 50% adjustment factor. And we said those programs had mandatory receiving zones, and they were applying a 50% adjustment factor to try to make the economics work. Ours is voluntary. And at the outset of the program, if we're going to make this work, we're probably going to have to err on the side of lower credit values to prime the market as receiving zones come online.
You know, it's occurred to me that I'm not clear on the distinction between voluntary and mandatory. So let me say it to make sure I understand it.
You got it.
There was designated receiving zone. Within that zone, if somebody wants to build an above allowable density, are they or are they not required to acquire HDCs? Can they build at a higher density without HDCs within
the
receiving
zone? Not if it's a receiving
zone
that's been designated by the Highlands Council.
All right, so when we're saying mandatory voluntary, we meant that we cannot mandate a certain area. Well, once an area is designated a receiving zone, all developments within that receiving zone must use HDCs.
Yes.
As opposed to like a variance route through a planning board?
Yeah, or as opposed to just deciding to build at a higher density without buying HDCs.
If you're going to be building,
so the Long Island model, and I think the Pinewoods model is the same, you have to use the development credit, so you can't go above density in the municipality.
Correct. Correct. You don't want to, if the Highlands Council has designated a receiving zone, which means the municipality has voluntarily agreed to do that, then any development within that receiving zone is going to have a component, a mandatory component, where you're building above what your base density or base intensity.
So our voluntary receiving zones, once they're accepted as receiving zones, will become mandatory within the receiving
zone. Right, but what I mean by here in this case,
we're not mandating.
We cannot mandate where the receiving zones, where in the Pinelands program, for example, they were able to designate where, you know, the regional growth areas were going to develop.
I'm not sure why the incentive then is. You're concerned that a municipality that's contemplating a voluntary receiving zone wants to make sure the developers
get an up a lot value markup? I mean,
yes.
Why would they be, is that a little cart before the horse? And the municipality is going to be concerned about so many things in picking a receiving zone. You really think they're going to be concerned about the developer's marketplace?
You have to be concerned with that, because if the marketplace for that development doesn't make economic sense, it's never going to get developed. So that needs to be a consideration up front, not just with the municipality, but with the council in establishing these credit values. And in this case, because the designation of receiving zones is voluntary, there's no municipal obligation to do it.
Yeah.
If we're going to have developers that are going to want to see that type of increased density or intensity occurring in the region or within the Seven Islands counties, then there's going to have to be a realization of a profit motive. Without it, TDR doesn't work.
Well, that's understood.
What was the incentive for the initial municipality?
Right.
And Jeff, question here about the incentive for the municipality.
What is the incentive for the municipality to accept higher density?
There are a number of incentives, Mr. Halpin, provided under the Highlands Act. The first and foremost is if you meet that minimum residential density threshold of 5 dwelling units per acre or its non-residential equivalent, the municipality has the ability to assess impact fees for all development within a receiving zone. It's a one-time fee, but it's a fee that they can use to defray capital costs relating to, let's say, development of infrastructure to serve the construction that's going on in the receiving zone. It could be used for school construction costs. It could be used, for example, for the purchase of a fire truck because the municipality has chosen to go increase the height requirements in their receiving zone to go from 2 stories to 5, and they don't have a ladder truck that can service it. Those are the types of things. So that's the first incentive under the Act. The second is they can receive up to $250,000 in enhanced planning grant monies from the council, these monies that are already set aside to help them defray the cost of going through that process. There are grant monies to help them with the cost of amending their local master plan and development regulations to accommodate these receiving zones, in essence to pay their lawyers and consultants to do the work of drafting the local ordinances that will implement it. There are priority considerations for infrastructure for state spending from the state. And then the last one for municipalities within the planning area. This doesn't apply outside, but within the ability to receive legal representation by the council for challenges relating to that receiving zone. So where there's the municipality and the Highlands Council work together to designate a receiving zone, that zone is consistent with the regional master plan, and now someone comes in challenging it, saying either we don't like it for whatever reason, we believe it's unconstitutional or illegal, the council actually steps up and the state represents that municipality in those challenges. Those are the primary benefits under the Act.
Can we just flesh out, or have we fleshed out, the first one, the impact fee? We're saying that we will allow the towns to have the ability to charge that, but is it in the context of, like an example in my head might be, if you had the zoning allowed 4-story construction in a town and they had fire apparatus to service that, and then through the TDR program we allowed them to go another 20%, it would allow the developer to go another 20%, which means like another floor, and now they need a whole other fire engine. Are they charging an impact fee based on the entire project? Have we set any parameters, or is it up to the town to negotiate whatever the impact is?
Under the TDR section, Mr. Chairman, in the Highlands Act, it specifically lays out that the municipality, in being able to assess these impact fees, must do this by municipal ordinance. And the capital costs that they are trying to offset with this impact fee gets assessed across all development within the receiving zone, not just the bonus units. So if you had a 50-unit residential development as your base zoning, and now it allows you to double it and go up to 100, you would be able to assess that impact fee across all 100 units. But the costs, the capital costs that you're trying to offset must be reasonably related to the development that is occurring within the receiving zone. So if the municipality, through its municipal ordinance, can demonstrate that this is the cost associated with serving as a receiving zone, we have these costs, and we need to put an addition on our school, for example.
Right.
Or, you know, we need a new fire apparatus. Once they've done that, again, there are very specific requirements under the TDR section about what they need to show, but it's got to be reasonably related. But other than, at this point, other than those parameters, we haven't established any additional parameters. We haven't put together a model ordinance yet, for example, but we will be working towards that. Yes.
This would also tie in with our core obligations?
Yes, I mean, right now as it stands, if a municipality is going to serve as a receiving zone and they're intending to grow, that will have an effect on their COA obligation. The other consideration that I don't think I have up here, but I want to mention, was that where a municipality designates the receiving zone, designates it, meets the threshold requirement, and can now assess impact fees, those impact fees also affect the credit price and the price of a project. So that was one of our other considerations, is looking at if a municipality was able to assess up to $15,000 per unit and you're establishing an HDC value at $16,000, that's $31,000 in additional cost that the developer would have to bear. And we needed to keep that in mind. So that also had an effect on our examination, if you will, of what the initial value should be. And the key point, again, that I'm reminded of is that this is an initial value. A property owner is not required to sell their credits at that value. They could sell it for less. If they could sell it for more as we get more receiving zones, that's certainly the hope. And as demand for those credits and opportunities to use those credits increase over time, those values, like we've seen in any other TDR program, will go up.
Jeff, the township's not, if they're going to assess impact fees for all development in the receiving area, do they have the authority to not assess impact fees against the TDR bonus development?
They could structure it any way they want. It's just the act kind of sets the ceiling, if you will, on how they can assess those fees. But if a municipality chose to, let's say they could justify $15,000 per unit, but the municipality said, you know what, for whatever reason, we're only going to choose to assess a $7,500 per unit impact fee, they could certainly do that. So based on the work that we did, we had a regional lot value, again, as I mentioned, of $64,000, $65,000. And then when we made our 75% reduction for developers willingness to pay, it came out to $16,164.31. We rounded that down to $16,000 for administrative purposes. And just to place that value into context, right now the current average price per right in the Pinelands PDC program is $18,000. They have gone up as high as $40,000 per right in about 2005, 2006. Some were transacting at $35,000, $38,000, $40,000 was the absolute max on several transactions. But they also started out at $2,500 per right. And if you were to put that into 2008 dollars, that's about $5,200 per credit. Just, again, to place it into context. And then a study was also done by the Regional Plan Association and the Environmental Defense Fund, 2005 into 2006, when they finalized it. And they tried to gauge this developer's willingness to pay measure. They wound up looking through sales data information and tried to come up with values on a county basis, both for the county within the Highlands and outside the Highlands. And the only county that they didn't have information for was Hunterdon. But for the other six counties, they were able to arrive at values. So those values ranged from $14,000 for Warren County within the Highlands region up to $108,000 in Burden County. Now,
did that assume the payment of an impact fee?
No, it did not.
Okay.
it look purely at, if you were looking at zoning across the Highlands region, whatever that zoning is, simply going up one additional residential unit,
right,
what would that, what would a developer be willing to pay to get that one single unit increase in density?
Okay.
And so because we've normalized or tried to normalize for these significant real estate market variability across the region, you know, we would be probably looking at values closer to this $14,000 range as opposed to $108,000, because our allocation process accounts tries to account for the, that valuation difference. So again, just trying to put things into perspective based on the work that the council did. So what are the next steps? For the bank, the bank's going to need to determine under what circumstances it will be purchasing Highlands Development Credits to alleviate unique and extenuating financial circumstances, the hardship cases, and then what amount it's going to pay per HDC. This will be the primary work of the bank, you know, over the next several to few months here. And so just wanted to kind of end on that note, give you a sense of where we are, what we did with the program, how it's arranged, and if you have any other additional questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, I really appreciate that to everyone for the explanations that you brought forth. Hopefully, the directors that had already been involved with programs such as Susan and Ralph have a better feel for it. I know that I was fortunate to be a part of the committee, so I think I get that math a little better. I know that there are some other tools that maybe some of the other directors feel they would like a little bit more to build on in their knowledge. I know you had some more examples, let's say, that maybe you can help them with from prior presentations. I think that would be helpful. Mike, you want to join us up front? And we'll just, you can stay there a minute just in case some other questions come up on this. Just so you're clear on who you're talking about. No, I appreciate this overview, Jeff, that you went with. Is there anything between now and the next meeting that the directors should start to think about and what the staff will be working on so that we're better prepared when we walk in here? Any background that you feel we need to be thinking about?
No, we've been working on some draft operating procedures. We need to finalize those internally to then present, you know, to, for the bank's consideration. Yeah, that kind of build on the bylaws and then the work that the bank is going to have to do. And certainly when we, before we get to the point of actually considering them, there'll be a lot of discussion by the board members about what are really the goals of the bank. How they relate to the policies that they're going to have to adopt, an acquisition policy, policies relating to how do we prioritize, how does the bank prioritize which parcels it purchase credits for due to hardship cases and
so
like.
I would expect our policy committee to start to ramp up
in the short term, yes.
Okay.
The other thing is if you have any questions arising out of today that occur to you as you try to go to sleep tonight and can't, or whatever, please feel free to send those questions to me, and then I'll make sure we work on them together.
That'd be funny. Staff. I could have slept like a baby 20 minutes ago.
Thank you for not doing so.
That was good. Let me open.
I don't have a question as much as just a brief comment, so that when we get into more detail on these policies, my position on this will come as a surprise. Not to go into great detail on it, but this entire evaluation system, which is mind-boggling with the detail, the amount of work that went into this, it's like looking at an Egyptian pyramid saying, couldn't they put it over there? I mean, you know, it's just kind of hard to criticize this structure and this impossible mission of trying to preserve equity across municipal lines between Bergen and Warren County. I mean, there are two places on the planet more different than Bergen and Warren County that have any kind of cohesion with something like the Pinewood Highlands Act. I can't think of them. And I can see this would function as a credit program in which there's a receiving area
where there is a way to convert these credits into receiving area credits that add to development. However, in the absence of a receiving area, if anyone's contemplating credit acquisitions to get the momentum started, but there is no receiving area in which they are to be applied, what we are in effect then doing is an easement acquisition program, with the hope of then selling those easements, converting them into sellable credits. And with all due respect to the tremendous amount of work that's gone into this, this is not an adequate system for measuring easement value. And if we are to use this as a land acquisition model, I think the model that has been explained to us will only function where there is a complete market transaction from sending to receiving. And if it's just an interim step, and if the bank is going to be in the position of just acquiring credits without a place to actually sell those credits, this is going to have to wait until the market. It's going to, I don't know that this would replace an easement appraisal system, which is what we rely on for the actual acquisition programs. And that's, enough said on that.
I just want to make sure that my perspective is that the most complex analysis is the allocation process, and I feel pretty comfortable with the outcome of that as a snapshot in the relative value of parcels of land across the region. The initial value that's been established is just, I would almost describe it as a target or a starting point. The ultimate value of a specific transaction may in fact be based on appraisal. It may be in fact based on an arm's length transaction between the bank and a willing seller, a willing buyer, willing seller, which by themselves. And the analysis is the statute requires the identification of an initial value, and in other programs as a reference point for the process you're describing, as a starting point or a reference point, that's all it's intended to serve as, and your assessment of what it will require to do a transaction, I believe, is correct. But I don't see redoing the initial value. It's a reference point, and now we go forward.
But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that the acquisition by this bank of credits, not all credits are the same. A credit that has a market to which it can go is different than a credit that's being acquired and stockpiled here.
And you'll find, I believe, that there are also credits that come from particular parcels of land which have a higher priority for conservation than others. We understand that and are trying to set it up. And this is the allocation, as I say, I think is fine. The initial value is just a starting point, a generalized starting point of the conversation.
Can I add to that that the governor, under Executive Order 114, saw fit to give us the seed money for the HDC Bank to start the process? And I think this gets back to where Jeff's last slide is that we need to be looking at those unique and extenuating financial circumstances, those hardship cases. And the idea of that $10 million of seed money was to start the process, and at least knowing that we have a difficulty in getting those receiving areas, at least to be able to start addressing those issues. And then hopefully work on letting the market take over, continue to work with our grant program to get those receiving areas. Also, just to remind you that another object that, that we're working on here, objective, is to have a state TDR bill that would address the opportunity for the Pinelands and the Highlands to have receiving areas anywhere in the state. That's something that Director Kraft has been working on with our staff, with the council, and it's something we'd be asking the HDC Bank under Scott to continue and advocate for that, because that certainly would make this program more workable. But in the meantime, it's a $10 million seed money that the governor saw fit to allocate under Executive Order 114 was designed so that you could start the work of addressing these issues.
What is the what is the Highlands Council doing anything to promote these receiving areas? I mean, I see you have a few people that went for grants. Are you running any kinds of programs to educate towns and things like that, or is it just kind of there?
No, well, it is there, but on top of that, we've been trying to promote the grant program, but actually we had a discussion on this in the last couple of weeks with Jeff, because we're concerned about getting out there and marketing it. We've been doing that with Can Conformance at the moment. We're on average out 2 to 3 nights a week at the moment. Myself and Tom are doing informational sessions on Plan Conformance, but we always bring up TDR at those meetings. We always talk about if there is a redevelopment project in this town, if you are considering in anywhere in this municipality additional growth, then you should be looking at this program, because, and we speak about the advantages to a municipality. Now, what we're planning to do is, currently we're doing the build-out analysis under the regional master plan for the municipalities that are working with us. We have 73 municipalities of the 88 who have done a notice of intent, so we're working on plan conformance. The results of that build-out analysis will tell us about capacity in every municipality. So we'll be able to see if there are municipalities that, judging on the results of the build-out, have sewer capacity and have potable water capacity. That's in the more existing communities. That will give us a great indication of where to target programs to go out to those municipalities and do the exact same as we're doing for plan conformance now, but focus more on transfer development rights.
I mean, does that mean that you have a set of criteria that when you go into the municipality that you have these criteria to make sure they're not just accepting grants because it's a good way for them to find out something about their municipality? When I see the PACON took the grant, and obviously they didn't decide to go ahead with the program. So I'd like to think that the money is not being wasted in that way.
Right, and we do recognize that when they come in with an application, Jeff goes over that application and works with other staff to see, is there a realistic opportunity here? Mainly what they're looking at is infrastructure capacity. It's a feasibility study. We have said to towns that they're not bound to go through the program because we want to make sure that they don't feel that they're entering into it and not knowing what the results are, that they're bound to continue through the program. We recognize that the information they get out of a capacity analysis is something we'd like them to be aware of under the regional master plan. So the dollars spent on capacity analysis, we believe, are wise dollars. But we started the program before we started doing the build-out work with municipalities. So we think now moving forward, a lot of the work will be done under plan conformance so that a town coming into us into the future and saying we want to study this, we can immediately look at results that we have and say, look, we're looking at your results. We know who serves you with potable water. We know who serves you with sewer. And we know that there are capacity constraints already. So why would you need this money and where would you use it if you can't, if you're constrained already, it's already a limiting factor. So it will into the future give us even more information on these grants. But we're very aware, for example, the town of Clinton, when they came in, they showed us where they were already looking at on Route 173, where they saw opportunity for further development. And so they had good sites to study, and we do look at that when we're looking at these grants.
Okay, any other board members who'd like to ask any more questions before they step down and then we go to the public portion? Okay, for now? Okay, thank you. Okay, we have no other presentations at this point, so as per our agenda, we're going to go into the public comments. I would remind the members of the public that just like at the council meetings, we request that you limit your question and your comments to 3 minutes, and remind everyone that this isn't a question and answer period, that this is for comments only. Any questions or comments, as Eileen had stated earlier in the meeting, can of course be presented directly to the council, and they will work very closely and very hard to get you the information that you're seeking. So with that, I'll open it up to the public. Would anyone like to come forward and, Candy, come forward, just state your name for the record and tell us what you'd like to us to know.
I'm Candy Ashman from the Finance Commission, and I just had a couple of things I wanted to suggest. One is a question I have about, and you certainly don't have to answer this now, but one of the things in this what becomes mandatory use of PDCs in a receiving area is to consider whether you want to exempt affordable housing, which is something we've had to do, and I think it's something you need to think about. The other is...
It means that if somebody's got affordable housing element, the Pinelands Commission will give them a pass on the mandate of applying PDCs.
Yes.
Okay. That was actually why I was asking that question, because yeah. I thought that's what the part
and I couldn't quite hear what you were saying, so, but right. But well, yes.
I didn't state it as plainly as you did, but that's the point you're making, right? That
yeah, but somebody, you have to consider what you would do with someone who comes in with a project with their 20% of affordable housing, for instance. The other is, and it may be somewhere, Jeff, but I don't see anything that says how long an allocation is good for. When we allocate PDCs to a property, it's good for 2 years.
As is our specific.
And I couldn't find it, that's all. And the reason I bring that up is because lots of people, not lots, but some, use the PDCs for loans. And when you loan against, you know, borrow against them, and you have a stated, you need to have a stated time that that thing is good, so you know you have 10 HDCs or whatever it is for the length at least of the collateral on the loan. That way you can pay it back and start over and get a new allocation because you maybe built two houses on the property or something that changed the allocation. And thirdly is the issue of using the HDCs for investments for the same reason you need to have a definite allocation time so that when you sell them within that, say, ours are good for 2 years, and within that time someone can sell them to somebody else or they can, you know, in order to, we have lots of people in the Pines now that have I won't use the word, I guess, hoarded PDCs. And they just use them as investments, and they hang on to them, and when they're $2,500, you hang on, and when they're $40,000, you sell. And, of course, our program is totally market-driven. It's all between the buyers and sellers, where the price goes. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member of the public like to speak? No?
Helen Heinrich, representing New Jersey Farm Bureau. And I imagine some of you have some very intricate questions. I've been following this process very closely for, I don't know, 4 years, but whatever it's been taking. And I still have questions. First of all, where is the tool? We've been promised the interactive tool on the website for months, if not years, and I thought there was a consultant hired to bring that into being. How can you determine what sort of interest there would be in finding out about your credits, which you're going to need to know whether you'd be overwhelmed with people saying they have a hardship or whether everybody's going to sit back and see what happens. So is there any way that you can really push that tool? Because I think people would like to be able to test it and see what they have. And then if you have some idea of the number of hits on that tool, you may get a sense of what your interest in the program is going to be. Secondly, the reducing the initial value by 75%, and that being based on a study of 06, I think you said. I mean, we're in a very different situation now. Is there some way that you can we look at that, because it may be the 75% is the wrong number to be using. I know it is something that landowners feel, compared to the other conservation programs, is unacceptable. And maybe given the economic situation, we can get something better. I mean, even 50% would be better than that. And then what I need to have some clarification about: when a town conforms and they get involved in designating a sending area, it was our understanding that that would be, that the values there would be based on the August 04 values, just like land in the preservation area. Is that the case? Or it seemed like you were saying that during the conformance process, you're going to be using a different date for the appraisals. And you don't need to answer my question now if you don't want to, but this is a very important point, I think, to the landowners. So, other than that, we're glad to get this process started, and let's move forward.
Thank you. Any other member of the public like to ask questions? Mr. Schill?
David Shope. Early on in Jeff LaGava's presentation, he spoke about immediate impact. Well, the immediate impact occurred 5 years ago. There is no more immediate impact. It's long gone. Section 13 of the Highlands Act says that you should endeavor to establish a Highlands Bank within 18 months of the enactment of the Act. And the failure to have a regional master plan in that period of time should not deter you from doing so. So this is a little late, to say the least. The average age of a farmer in New Jersey is 57. And what I heard today was, it's going to take time. It's going to take time. 5 years have already passed. The time has passed. And quite frankly, the strategy, the long-term strategy that this act has, is to wait for us to die. It's as simple as that. And then when the question came up about assessing land within the same township at the same value, that completely disregards the unique features of the land, to wit, views and stuff like that. You're painting everything East German gray. And the COA obligations, so it seemed to me that this should be an additional source of money to the landowner, because with the TDRs go the COA obligations, and you have not addressed that. And the $16,000 initial offering price is nothing more than a transfer of wealth, well, it's actually the destruction of wealth in the Highlands area, to the benefit of builders in the yet-to-be-determined receiving areas, because they will be driven by the profit motive. If it doesn't make sense to them, they won't do it. And in the meantime, for us to be at the mercy of a builder's profit motive somewhere else has got it backwards. Then I was surprised to hear about in addition to the 75% reduction to get to $16,000, prior to that, a 30% reduction. That was not adequately explained to me. And a lot value of $64,000, which again was at the end of Jeff LaGava's presentation, I haven't seen a lot valued at $64,000 anywhere here in 25 years. These numbers are crazy. This is a plan destined to fail. It is a plan destined to scoop up TDR credits from people who are in desperate times, at desperate prices. And if anyone is one of those people and you have an incurable disease, don't tell this council, because you won't even get $16,000. That concludes my comments.
Thank you. Members of the public in the front, Mr. Jansky.
My name, excuse me, my name is Hal Danielson, and I concur with the comments of Dave. You know, we're not getting any younger. This Highlands Council has been going on for 5 years. Why this TDR issue wasn't addressed more aggressively in the beginning, I don't know. What I didn't hear today was that any timeline to come up with a fulfilled project, which is normally what we would do, to come up with that, as well as a timeline for the acceptance of these TDRs. There's nothing about a time constraint on this at all. And because they are strictly voluntary, this can drag out for years and years and years. And there should be some kind of a timeline on this where you have to call a halt to it. You know, you would have to start working harder and faster in order to accomplish these goals. This is done with every project that I've been involved in, you know, building factories and everything else. But right now, you really haven't addressed any of this, which is paramount to us. We're the landowners. We're not getting any younger. We like to go on and enjoy our lives, but you've constrained us with this. And it has had a severe impact on many people. But we're not going to give in. There are more than one avenues. We need a representation from the landowners that are affected by this legislation. We don't have any. We don't have a voice. The only voice that we have is at the end of public hearing. We don't have an ombudsman, one that can interact for us. Nothing. I mean, there are folks out there that are uninterested or they're uncovered. They're not covered by this, so they don't care. When I brought up before at a prior meeting, I said there were grants given to various other things, including the nonprofits, and I said, what about the landowners? And the retort back was, we're taking no questions. Well, we're the ones that are at risk here. The folks up there on the board aren't at risk. We are. We don't have any voice, though. We've been stifled for 5 years. And what we're saying now is enough of this is enough. We have to have certain facts and figures ahead of us. Where we're going with this, what's happening. There's no reason why a property owner should underwrite a private enterprise, which we are doing now. Everybody says the American Water Company must be American. Or some of the other companies must be American. No. The big holders in this actually go to the Thames Water Company, which is in turn owned by a German consortium. And the other portion of the large water suppliers and or distributors in the state are owned by Suez. Both of these have abysmal records as to what they've done to people. And yet, we're paying for this. Budweiser beer? Oh, we'll pay for it. You know, the property owners are paying for this. You know, when it comes to compensating us, tough luck. We're not going to do it. The state doesn't have the monies. Mr. Smith went on public record saying that the monies were there. They're not there. And, you know, we try to believe what our legislatures say. We figure that they're men of honor, and their word is gospel, and we believed it, much to our dismay. So here we are today. We don't have any timelines, nothing. And also, I would appreciate a list of references for the TDRs. Now, I realize in a PowerPoint presentation you can't submit them, but we should know where these sources are for your figures. And if you could supply this list of references, we would appreciate it. That's about it, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Dressler.
Mr. Chairman, I have to pick up 3 o'clock call.
Okay. Thank you, Susan.
Mr. Chairman, what's our quorum here?
We're 5. Yeah.
We need 5.
We can continue, but still, no action can continue.
Right. Right. For public portion.
Let me know if you have a quorum. I'm on the same board.
Oh, okay. I understand.
Just holler if you have a quorum problem.
That's between you.
Andy Drysdale, Chester Township. Today I have a couple of suggestions for you if you would like to maybe try them on for size. One is that when you all reach retirement age, that you donate 67 to 75% of your retirement to a bogus environmental cause. It appears that TDRs are valued at about somewhere around 14%, I was using your numbers up there, of the real value in 2004. Envision that a few years from now, when the dollar has depreciated substantially due to the printing of money by the federal government, which I believe will happen, just think of that. You know, maybe the value of the TDR might double in dollars, but if the dollars are worth half as much, you didn't gain much. Suggestion number two. In light of what has happened in this state and is happening at the federal level, I suggest that all of you who are in bed with the state and many others in this room who are in bed with the state, study the history of this country. And you can go to libraries and look up, you know, old magazines back in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And it could be very interesting. And see what has happened when government becomes too powerful and takes away the many rights, too many rights, and raises taxes too much, which has already happened, and always has happened. And programs like this, you know, every program the government creates, they never go away. People just keep making it grow, stealing the money out of it. So, you know, try it on for size. Thank you.
Any other member of the public with any comments? Dave?
Thank you. Dave Pfeiffer from the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commissions. I want to speak with you today, assuming that your program is a success and that you have preserved land where you want it preserved and you have caused good development to happen and created good communities where you want them to happen. I urge you to give some serious thought to how it is that you're going to guarantee that preserved lands remain preserved and are not violated in the future. We still have some concerns at ANJEC about municipalities holding conservation restrictions on property in terms of monitoring and enforcement. And I think the bank needs to think about and provide some resources for the maintenance, monitoring, and enforcement of conservation restrictions, whatever their form may be, on the preserved property. So think about that as you're achieving success, but not too long, because we really need to know that what the public has wrought here in the public's name is actually going to be deliverable in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, and hopefully what we're talking about is perpetuity here. So I urge you to think about that long and hard. Thank you.
Any other member of the public comments this time? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public portion. Board, is there any other comments from board members?
Not for me.
No?
Okay. In light of Dave's remark, this is the question then. When I assume the plan is to follow the same as past TDR programs, as the state law allows, is that the development, that a deed restriction is filed at the county with, so that anybody who does a title check will see that, So it's the same as everywhere else. It's not something unique. You're just concerned about who holds the easements or who holds the retired development rights. You're concerned that once they're retired,
nobody's assigned with the mission of making sure they're out there.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Make sure I understood his comments as well as his concerns.
May I respond to the questions Mr. Danielson asked about the references? Because I'm not sure if Mr. Danielson was in the room when at the start of the PowerPoint. The information part that was shown in the PowerPoint today, if you go to the website and today's calendar page, we've prepared a memo which actually references the technical document so that you wouldn't have to wade all the way through the technical document. It gives you the actual pages you should look at and all the references there and the information on the figures and the data is all in that document. So I just wanted to let all the members of the public know that and our board members.
Okay, thank you. Okay, if there's no other business to attend to, a motion to adjourn?
Suppose.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Stand adjourned. Thank you.